The 30% Club mentoring pilot, which became an annual program growing rapidly each year, the fifth cohort involves 85 organizations and over 1,500 people, also showed that mentees wanted to hear bigger, bolder, inspiring ideas from speakers beyond the corporate world. This might have been a challenge for me to arrange, but out of the blue I received a letter from Theresa May, then Home Secretary and Minister for Women and Equalities. Mrs. May asked if I would meet one of her constituents, Liz Dimmock, as she thought we might be able to help each other. Liz is an impressive woman. Formerly global head of coaching at HSBC, in 2012 she also cycled the Tour de France, the entire Tour de France course a week ahead of the race. Women are not allowed to officially compete in the flagship race. Liz recognised that businesswomen and sportswomen could learn a lot from each other and founded a social enterprise to encourage that through mentoring Women Ahead. We met and I realised just how much Liz and her team could add to the nascent 30% Club scheme, including sourcing exciting speakers from the worlds of sport, art and entertainment. Not only could these speakers inspire mentees, they would expose mentors, often very senior executives, to fresh ideas. One particular event stands out for me, a mesmerising talk by voice coach Patsy Rodenberg, whose clients are mainly well-known actors such as Orlando Bloom, on how to command both a room and a conversation. Patsy had asked if she could speak to the group for 2 hours. Conscious that we had a lot of senior people in the room and doubtful that anyone could hold our attention that long, I limited her to 90 minutes, but regretted that. As I looked out at the 400-strong audience, I could see that everyone, man and woman, mentor and mentee, was hanging on her every word. Patsy made us all think differently about how we engage with our colleagues, friends and family, how we can be more present and powerful in our conversations. I have undertaken many presentation skills courses, but all in the context of corporate training. None were as helpful as Patsy's insights. Again, CEOs can encourage more innovative thinking in their own organisations by inviting in charismatic speakers beyond the usual roster. If access to these talks is linked to mentoring or tutorial programmes, that might be an additional incentive for more people to get involved. Business leaders can also give the stage to internal orators to share their blue sky thinking, giving people the license to come forward with their ideas. A program that deliberately cultivates and celebrates new thinking is a simple design evolution and one that can have many positive second-order effects. It shows an openness of mind, a willingness to listen to new concepts that may challenge the status quo. These are just a few examples of practical changes that can help CEOs press the diversity reset button to encourage people to think anew about the issue of broadening talent at all levels, making all roles open to agile working, not part-time, but doing the work with minimal constraints, advertising new positions under the banner Happy to Talk Flexible Working, and promoting returnships, bridges back into work for those who've had a career break, are three other radical, not really, ideas. The various suggestions can be grouped together under a task force, but the issue shouldn't be outsourced to human resources or even to an executive sponsor. These resources can certainly help, including with project management, but it's very important that CEOs are directly engaged. A CEO's job is demanding, but we can all find time to do the things that matter. It sends a very strong signal when a CEO is personally involved in mentoring, in tutorials, in attending some of the innovative thinker speaking events, in interviewing left-field job candidates, and promoting those who work flexibly. Experimentation is key. Most businesses don't experiment adventurously when it comes to their own organisational structures and working practices. This is unsurprising, the hassle, and the inevitable, more immediate priorities. But if the goal is genuine improvement and nothing has worked so far, the starting point must be an open mind. Newer companies are able to start the way they mean to go on. I heard a presentation from the founder of a successful investment company whose first 12 employees boasted 9 different first languages between them. He admitted that this ultra-diversity made communication hard in the early days. I'm frequently asked for extra ideas to help sectors that are particularly male-dominated, such as technology, engineering, or finance. First, we need to be honest with ourselves about how much of the imbalance is cultural and can be addressed, and how much might be down to our different levels of interest on average in these fields. The goal is not to pressure girls into careers that they might not be especially interested in, but which are portrayed as superior to those they might actually enjoy. That seems to me to undermine women rather than boost us. But if a girl does love physics or maths, the first ever female winner of the prestigious Fields Medal was announced in 2014, an Iranian mathematician, Miriam Mirzakhani, who sadly died of breast cancer 3 years later, aged just 40, then we need to ensure that she perceives that she can fulfill her potential and for the reality to match that perception. Image is an additional problem for companies in these industries. It's very hard to change perceptions without a concerted sector-wide effort. As we've already seen, technology companies are amongst the most challenged, particularly when it comes to attracting female engineers. But they have confronted the criticism and a potentially vicious spiral directly by publishing their adverse data, saying it's not good enough, and committing to keep publishing to show how they're improving. Different sectors face different challenges. In 2012, a number of the managing partners of professional services firms, lawyers, accountants, and management consultants, asked the 30% Club for help. These firms are usually able to attract plenty of women at entry level, often more than half their intake, but struggle to achieve anything approaching gender balance at partnership level. At the time, female partners were 15% of the law firm average, 17% at accountancies. They hoped that collectively, under what they termed the safe harbour of the 30% Club, they might be able to achieve the breakthrough that had eluded them all individually. Looking across 10 legal and 7 accountancy firms, we found that a man was 10 times more likely to make partner at a law firm than a woman who had joined at the same time, 3 times more likely at accountancy firms. This was despite these firms doing a lot to address the issue. Most could show me long lists of specific initiatives aimed at developing their female talent, and some had been working on the issue for many years. In a special project for the 30% Club, McKinsey surveyed over 700 people across these firms. They found a big gap between what the managing partners were saying about the importance of diversity and the commitment of even those who reported directly to them. 3/4 of managing partners considered diversity to be a strategic priority. When asked anonymously, only 40% of senior partners and 25% of managers expressed a similar view. The lack of real commitment amongst those who are managing lots of people was an obvious impediment. It was also a tough message for the managing partners, but as one of them put it, we needed to know this is a tipping point. For them, it had become about sustainable success, about profits. Those at the top could see clients demanding more diversity. We've entered pitches with an all-male team to come across a team of 50% women on the client side and face an adverse reaction. It was already becoming hard to attract even traditional top talent. Unless we can solve this, we won't be able to attract and retain the best and brightest young men or young women. Those UK-based professional services firms who asked the 30% Club for help did set and publish voluntary targets for female partners while making very clear design changes to modernise their working practices. Some were quite rudimentary. In 2012, we discovered that only 1/3 of these firms had proper work allocation processes. At the others, the best projects, the ones that would help set associates on the path to promotion, tended to be given out by partners to people who were, well, junior versions of themselves. Introducing a robust work allocation process was a simple first step. Some of the firms have gone further, reviewing business models to move away from the outdated billable hours system so they measure output rather than input, and managing their talented women in a gender-intelligent way. Those design changes have had a demonstrable impact. McKinsey's follow-up review in 2015 showed that men were now only 3 times more likely than women to be promoted to partner at law firms. In the best cases, the proportion of female partners appointed at one major law firm was a record 40% in 2017. Progress has been achieved by many people doing many things differently. These firms are now measuring and managing their talent pipelines much more closely, carefully preparing women for the next stage towards partnership, rather than waiting until they may have missed a step. They work harder at closing the deal when women hesitate. One accountancy firm told me they had offered partnership to 2 high-performing women and had been shocked when both turned the offer down. Rather than leave it there, a senior female colleague invited each separately to a meeting and discovered that both were pregnant with their first child and anxious about the firm's expectations if they accepted the promotion. Both were encouraged to accept, and did, with the reassurance that if they wanted to work fewer hours, that would be fine. The women said they were pleased the intervention was made and were happy that they were persuaded to change their minds. My own industry, the investment and savings profession, is a latecomer to the diversity agenda, and our statistics are terrible, not only in the UK but globally. CityWire analyses the numbers of women managing money around the world, based on the fund managers in its extensive database. Its 2017 report covered 15,316 active managers, just 1,615, 10.5%, are female. And it turns out that even this overstates things. Only 809 women run funds by themselves. Yet I am testament to the fact that fund management can be a great career not just for women with families, but for anyone who wants to be judged on results rather than hours at the desk. The industry has, if anything, gone backwards since the financial crisis. The image issue has become an even bigger obstacle. In 2016, as chair of the Investment Association, the UK's industry trade body, I hosted a breakfast roundtable to discuss what we should do about the situation. I asked the 40 attendees, all senior at their respective firms, to submit a short biography, not in the usual glittering prizes format, but along lines that captured their personal characteristics and backgrounds. Mine read, "I am white British, went to a co-ed comprehensive school, then to Cambridge where I read philosophy, joined Schroders straight from university on their graduate programme, was a fixed income fund analyst for them in New York, returned to London as a fixed income fund manager before moving to Newton in 1994. I was CEO of Newton from 2001 to 2016 and am now leading a new venture, Personal Investing, for Legal and General Investment Management. I am married. My husband and I have 9 children, and he is a stay-at-home dad." Reading the compilation, which showed a wide range of educational attainment levels and many experimental early careers, we agreed that few of us would make it through our own, more standardised recruitment processes today. Many firms were stipulating a maths or economics degree, for example. The breakfast led to the Diversity Project, an intense collaborative effort to improve industry diversity across all its dimensions. I'm frequently asked if businesses should target gender first or whether it's better to address multiple aspects of diversity all at once. I believe there was a time and a place for the 30% Club's razor-light focus on gender. Newer initiatives, like the Diversity Project, should be more holistic from the start. That doesn't equate to a generalised, vague, and therefore doomed attempt to achieve progress. We still need targeted actions. But broader diversity goals can actually be more effective for women's advancement than just gender. A male colleague told me not so very long ago, "I don't know why you focus on women so much. They never had it so good." Which revealed a great deal about his personal feelings regarding all the recent attention paid to female talent. I'm certainly conscious that this attention may have inadvertently made it harder for companies to work out how to address those other dimensions. At one point, the idea of a 20% target for ethnic minority board directors was mooted in the UK, which initially sounds promising, but what about LGBTQ+ representation? Disability? The 30% Club's numeric target was helpful as a means of addressing one source of underrepresentation, but extending the exact same approach quickly feels problematic. Diversifying talent is about wanting more ideas to open up the pool of talent, not to manufacture a pop band. Ultimately, we want diversity of thought, and that takes a subtler approach than 3 women, 2 ethnic minority, 1 gay, 1 disabled, 1 young, etc. How can we find solutions for the 100%? Melody Hobson is an accomplished African-American businesswoman and non-executive board director. She is a driving force behind efforts to improve the representation of black directors on boards of American companies, currently around 9% on Fortune 500 companies, compared with 13% of the population. Less than 1% of CEOs of the same Fortune 500 companies are black. There are just 4 today, and since Ursula Burns stepped down as the CEO of Xerox Corporation, none of them are women. Burns is, to date, the only African-American woman to have ever led a Fortune 500 company. Melody invited me to speak at the 2016 Black National Corporate Directors Conference in California and interviewed me alongside a white male Fortune 500 CEO. The CEO had analysed his company's customer base and found that 2/3 were not white men. Instead of addressing just gender or race, they were working towards approximating this 2/3 other within the company's board and management team. There was continued support for initiatives focusing on specific underrepresented groups, but the overall goal was to reduce the dominance of the unrepresentative white male leadership. This approach is not just appealingly holistic, but a powerful reminder that the other forms the majority. Finally, let's talk frankly about the complex issues facing female CEOs in promoting diversity. We have seen how the male chairman had a transformative impact in improving the gender balance in Britain's boardrooms. But even now, when senior men have become so much more involved, few women at the top seem completely comfortable playing a leading role. Those who do can be hugely inspirational. Alison Britton, CEO of Whitbread, gave a brilliant address at the Financial Times Women at the Top conference in 2016. She shared her experience of making the move from a managing director at a bank to a FTSE 100 CEO at Britain's largest hospitality company. Alison explained that as a new CEO, she had underestimated the impact that her every remark, even her mood, would have in her team. She overheard a colleague say, "She doesn't look very happy. I don't think she liked our presentation," as they left the room. In fact, Alison was looking glum because she had suddenly remembered her daughter's maths homework and was trying to recall how to do quadratic equations. In sharing her stories, Alison showed her humanity, making her, for me, a real role model. Her willingness to stand up as a female CEO is, however, far from the norm. Others are more ambivalent, not, it seems, because they don't want to encourage other women, but because they do not want to be seen as flying the women's flag. A direct quote from a FTSE 100 female executive. There is a view that real businesswomen should be focusing on real business issues rather than on women. But of course, these are part of the same agenda. I understand the anxiety. I have felt it myself. But by being in any way reticent, female business leaders perpetuate the notion that gender equality is still a special interest topic, or, just as bad, that it's a career risk to champion other women. Those who have stepped up should be celebrated. So my friend Suki Sandhu, founder of the Outstanding and Empower lists, recognising gay and ethnic minority executive role models respectively, and I have worked with the Financial Times to create a new list of heroes to do just that. Heroes is not a power list as such. Those on it have many impressive career achievements, but the clinching criterion is that they have encouraged the progression of other women. Melanie Richards, vice chair of KPMG in the UK, ranked number one on the inaugural list, is a wonderful example of someone who has worked hard on behalf of others over many years, often behind the scenes. I would love to see more female CEOs taking steps to change working practices. Yes, to be more female-friendly, but also to ensure that the next generation of both men and women can work smarter. Mary Portas has done just that. Portas is a retailing expert and broadcaster. Her TV programmes, including Mary Queen of Shops, and her charitable Living and Giving campaign have made her a household name in the UK. She suddenly realised after the birth of Horatio, her third child, and the first with her wife, Melanie Rickey, Portas was previously married to a man, that work wasn't making her happy. After more than 20 years building up a successful business, she tore up her own rulebook and decided to create a working life that she and others would enjoy. In a 2017 interview, she set out the new rules. She would no longer work with people she did not like. She would be home by 6 p.m, and as many people as possible who worked for her would be able to do the same. She said, "I realised how much of my life had been spent working and being treated like a man. Even the way I was presented on TV fitted that profile. I was supposed to be scary, ball-breaking, but deep inside I knew I wasn't like that." The catalyst for Mary's new approach was thinking about her own life. But as her interviewer, Margaret Driscoll, pointed out, Mary Portas has built a highly successful career on spotting trends. She has now reshaped her company around smart ways of working. Her top staff set their own hours, take open-ended maternity leave and as much holiday as they like. Portas points out, "This isn't just about women. I've got two men and two women on my board and the men love it. This is how men want to work too." Portas believes that, given freedom, people work smarter and harder. If they can choose how much time they take off, people actually spend less time away. This is borne out by the experience of market-leading entertainment company Netflix. Since 2010, Netflix's holiday policy has been to have no policy at all. Salaried employees can take as much time off as they'd like. The company focuses on what people get done, not how many hours or days they work. Autonomy makes people more accountable, not less. I don't think it's a coincidence that companies like Netflix, which set their own agenda based on what works rather than what we have been used to, have enjoyed a meteoric rise. I believe the word leapfrog is going to become familiar in the business world, as in Tesla has leapfrogged General Motors and Ford Motor Company to become America's most valuable car maker. We've only seen the start of the widening gulf between corporate winners and losers. There will be no hiding place for long-established brands as innovators create new, exciting and relevant products and services and ways of working that attract the best staff. In my view, three characteristics will have a strong bearing on who wins and who loses: smart use of technology, aligning with customers' values, and fostering diverse talent. We've covered a lot of ground, so here's a short checklist for CEOs who want results. 1. Analyze your data and listen yourself to the experiences of the underrepresented. Don't speculate. 2. Accept the results. Say what you're going to do to improve things. Set out timelines and milestones. Tear up the action plan that hasn't worked. 3. Aim to create voluntary buy-in to the project at all levels and involving the majority group. Drop the D word if necessary. 4. Make HR one of the most important areas of the business, right next to you, headed by a star. Talent, both individual and collective, is integral to strategy. Seek to create a talent ecosystem. 5. Consider every stage of the career life cycle and set goals with rewards for achievement. Carrots, not sticks. 6. Make design changes that work for your company around recruitment, promotion, and pay. Create more opportunities for varied talent to work together. Invite unusual speakers in to catalyze new thinking. Consider making every job open to agile or smart working. Drop the flexible tag too if it seems to carry stigma. 7. Advertise what you are doing, internally and externally. 8. Repeat step one and sustain the effort until it's no longer needed, and enjoy reaping a diversity dividend. Chapter 7. Get your head in the game. Nearly all successful people begin with two beliefs. 1. The future can be better than the present. 2. I have the power to make it so. David Brooks of the New York Times, quoted by Vala Afshar, Chief Digital Evangelist at Salesforce. Okay, so you're not quite a CEO yet. Perhaps you're still at school or university, just starting out on your career, or trying to work out how to take that very first step between the worlds of education and work. The previous chapter may have worried you. If diversity is now such a sensitive topic, if CEOs are still figuring it out, how can it be such a good time to be a girl? While it's important to be aware that the world of work isn't quite fixed yet, otherwise you might fall at the first hurdle, it's also important to realize that you can help create the conditions for your own success, whatever your circumstances. Getting your head in the game, being in the right frame of mind to explore your own potential, to take chances and then make the most of them, including picking yourself up and trying again if necessary, is a starting point. Please note, this is not a call to be aggressive. Banish all thoughts of owning it, bossing it, or killing it. It's a call to be open to possibilities. I have had a number of mentees from a wide range of socioeconomic, educational, ethnic, religious, and cultural backgrounds. Each has faced distinct challenges, including, for some, a big gulf between their own ambitions and their parents' expectations. Several have taken a bold and controversial step to embark on a career at all. One refused to enter into an arranged marriage. Another, still in her 20s, is constantly under pressure to start a family. A third, the mother of two, is struggling to develop a shared partnership with her husband around their family, although she is the one with the higher earnings and career potential. All these young women have skills, strong personalities, and high aspirations. How can they reconcile these conflicts, let alone develop their focus? At the start of each relationship, we work together to develop clearer goals. They've all, like me, started off with rather vague ideas about what personal success looks like. So I've asked each one to fast forward 5 years. What version of her future self would make the mentee feel happy and fulfilled? It's a revealing exercise. One young woman wrote being married right at the very top of her list and told me she had never even admitted that to herself before. Up until that point, she had thought of herself as first and foremost a career woman, and having made great sacrifices to get where she was surprised to realize that progressing further in her career did not feature in her priorities. It was clear that she needed to balance her life as well as reignite her enthusiasm for her work. You may be surprised that I do not in any way try to change her mind. Far from it. Progress isn't about being forced down a specific path. It's about having more scope to live the life you want. When we're in the midst of our own life, it's not always easy to accurately assess the way our priorities are changing. Taking time to step back from the day-to-day, to consciously assess and then reassess what's important to us now, helps us to see the right next steps. When I left Newton after so many years, I wasn't at all sure of my next move and needed both time and space to reflect. I also knew what made me happy at work. Being able to do a good job while also trying to improve society, to combine profit with purpose, was when I felt most fulfilled, most able to be myself. That, career-wise at least, was my definition of success. If you're right at the start, or feeling very unsure about what your own version of success looks like, stop and think for a moment about something you have done that has made you feel proud of yourself. It could be something that other people might not think of as particularly special. Or it could be something very obviously big. The key is to recognize that feeling of achievement, the distinct awareness that you overcame an obstacle or exceeded your own expectations, a sense of accomplishment that rarely comes when we are gifted an easy path. This is the feeling to aim for as you look to develop from where you are today. Note that it probably involves taking some risk. It's really difficult to make much progress if we stay inside our comfort zone. But even a small step beyond starts to expand our frontiers, and if we take enough of those small steps, we can grow much more than any of us might think possible. If anyone had said to me when I was a shy and gawky teenager that one day I would have 9 children and be the chief executive of an investment company and work on initiatives to drive gender equality, I would have laughed, nervously. Of course, those things happened over time, not in one fell swoop. When I told my boss that I was pregnant with my 7th child, he offered his hearty congratulations, but from the look on his face, I could see that he was unsure what it meant for the business. I tried to reassure him by pointing out that my family wasn't going from 0 to 7 children all at once. He smiled and replied, "That's a good way of thinking about it. In fact, it's just a 17% increase." I might not have put it quite like that, but taking things one at a time, including in our family, one baby at a time, has been an important part of not just coping, but expanding to meet the challenges as they have grown. I don't mind when people are curious about how I do it all. By now, it should be obvious that the answer is with help. Not so much paid help as lots of input from others. But it makes me uncomfortable when I'm labelled a superwoman. For a start, I don't feel super most of the time. I feel very human, with all the uncertainties and failings that come with our condition. More importantly, the description might discourage others by implying that certain goals are unobtainable. The truth is, I am just an ordinary girl from an ordinary background, not the cleverest or the most talented amongst any group of peers. I'm not saying that to be modest. All I have really done is to stretch myself, little by little, beyond what is regarded as the norm, and beyond my comfort zone. I'm also very persistent. As my boss alluded to when considering the news of my 7th child, each incremental change has looked quite feasible, even if the overall big picture is rather less so. I've learned to concentrate on that immediate next step. It's been an important factor in my life as well as my career, and not just because of the volumes of children or daily tasks, bigness of jobs, and so on. The compound effect of a series of small actions can be huge, either positively or negatively. Tiny differences in girls' education compared with boys, as we'll explore shortly, can accumulate to create a meaningful, adverse gap when it comes to being ready for the workplace. The minor deviations that as women we often take away from the career curve of our male colleagues, each barely perceptible, similarly add up over time until suddenly we are noticeably behind. The good news is we can avoid or correct these individually small divergences. Over many years, as I have gradually pushed out my own boundaries, it's become clearer to me that our feelings of limitations are often self-imposed or relative to standards set by others. Fabled investor Warren Buffett wrote a wonderful essay for Fortune magazine about the imbalance between his opportunities growing up and those of his sisters, simply because he was a boy. He put it so succinctly, "My floor became my sister's ceiling." "Now," he said, "thank heavens, the structural barriers are falling, but still an obstacle remains. Too many women continue to impose limitations on themselves, talking themselves out of achieving their potential." Referring to a friend, the late Catherine Graham, who lacked self-belief, He said he had told her to discard the funhouse mirror that others had set before her, and instead view herself in a mirror that reflected reality, a reality that was a match for anyone, male or female. I have never met Mr. Buffett, but in a taking-a-chance frame of mind, I once wrote to him, inviting him to become a member of the fledgling US chapter of the 30% Club. To my amazement, he wrote straight back, explaining how important he thought gender balance was, how he was aiming for this over the medium term for the board of Berkshire Hathaway, and the embarrassment he felt in telling a mother of nine that he wouldn't have much time to devote, but was happy to lend his support. He then added a lovely handwritten postscript, saying he had heard I was terrific. That was one of those exciting moments when I realised that the 30% Club idea was now influencing the influencers. Many of us suffer from distorted, unflattering visions of ourselves. Those crazy mirrors, like the ones at fun fairs, do exist in our minds. This is where faking till we make it, which less catchily is really consciously correcting our self-undermining tendencies until we make it, comes in handy again. You don't need to actually feel confident, but you need to appear confident. If you seem to believe in yourself, it makes others more likely to believe in you too, and that really does have a confidence-boosting effect. Eventually, no faking is required. In 2012, Amy Cuddy gave a brilliant TED Talk on how our body language can actually make us who we are. Most of us would agree with the notion that our mind can influence our body. Amy showed that our body can influence our mind. She set out the evidence that power posing for just 2 minutes before an important interview or presentation can make our testosterone levels rise and our cortisol levels fall, those hormones again, creating a more confident, more winning version of ourselves. Cuddy had watched classes of business school students and noticed that some people were caricatures of alphas, occupying the middle of the classroom, sort of spreading out, whereas others were virtually collapsing as they came into the room, and that those differences were related to gender. Women tended to shrink, men to expand. I see this all the time. At the same time, business schools were struggling with a gender grade gap. Men and women came into MBA courses equally well qualified, but women got lower grades at the end. Much of the gap was attributable to the women participating less in class, so Cuddy started to explore whether it was possible to get them to mimic the confidence they needed to participate more. The evidence from her experiments, where people were told to adopt certain physical poses and were then subjected to a tough job interview, was compelling enough. It turns out that adopting the Wonder Woman pose for just 2 minutes as preparation for an important performance, not on stage itself, enables us to act most powerfully. The clincher, though, was Cuddy's own life story. At the age of 19, she was involved in a bad car crash, suffering a head injury that adversely impacted her IQ, and with it, her self-esteem. Eventually, 4 years after her peers, she graduated from college, and then with the help of an angel advisor, Susan Fisk, went to Princeton. Her first challenge was to give a 20-minute talk to fellow students. The night before, she called Susan and said that she couldn't do it, that she wasn't supposed to be there, that she was an imposter. Her confidant told her, "You are going to fake it. You are going to do every talk that you ever get asked to do. You are just going to do it and do it and do it until you have this moment where you say, 'Oh my gosh, I'm doing it,' like I have become this." What was especially wonderful about this story was that Amy then described how she recognized a fellow student was suffering from the same misplaced lack of self-belief and was able to help her in a similar way. Much less dramatically, I have experienced a similar evolution, from being terrified about standing up on stage to really enjoying it. I used to feel physically sick before a big presentation, and that inevitably detracted from my performances. I couldn't channel the adrenaline to be effective. The first time I appeared on live TV, my eyes were visibly twitching. The only cure was to keep performing. I now mostly look forward to those big moments, seeing them as opportunities to communicate, to draw more people into my ideas, to gauge their reactions and learn from them. The turning point was when I moved my emphasis from thinking about how I felt to starting from the audience's perspective. What did I have to say that might really resonate with each person? What would enable them to enjoy the talk, to absorb the ideas rather than merely listen politely? Through trial and error, I learned I needed to talk without notes to get real audience engagement. I still needed to write out the speech so the structure and content were there, but then throw those notes away. It was not a coincidence that at that point I moved from being an okay-ish presenter to a sought-after one. I still mess up from time to time, but now see those as learning experiences, not a reason to hide away. I also still get nervous when pushing out my own frontiers. In 2015, I felt honoured to be asked to be a keynote speaker at the Women's Institute's wonderful 100th anniversary event at the Royal Albert Hall, but as I looked out from the wings at the capacity crowd of over 5,000, it was hard not to run. I have observed much the same pattern in others. I had seen a young analyst present to colleagues on several occasions and thought she would be a great speaker at our annual client seminar. Initially, she reacted enthusiastically, but she came to see me the next day and told me she felt anxious. She had never presented on stage before. She didn't know if she would be able to pull it off and was afraid of letting everyone down. While she was grateful for the opportunity, perhaps, she suggested, I should ask someone else. I asked if she might be prepared to give it a go, said that we would ensure she had plenty of training and practice, and if she continued to feel very nervous, she could pull out right up to the day before. I would have a backup plan. Having gone through many more hours of training than her colleagues, including a word-perfect rehearsal, she was, of course, the star of the show. When I congratulated her afterwards, she thanked me for not letting her turn the chance down. She had pushed herself beyond her comfort zone and learned new skills. Over the following months and years, she became one of the firm's most highly respected presenters. In recent years, I have also had the opportunity to see some ultra-powerful people, including prime ministers, government ministers, CEOs, and others with great influence up close. They are exposed to performance situations that most people would crumble just thinking about. While they have become practiced at delivering, often flawlessly, I have seen them in the wings. I can report that everyone has vulnerabilities, coping mechanisms, allies, and support systems. Even those who blithely say, "I never get nervous," have rituals before they go on stage. In many ways, they are just like you and me, wanting validation, still feeling vulnerable as human beings. In a radio interview, Sir Paul McCartney revealed fellow Beatle John Lennon's insecurities before mentioning that he himself avoids reading reviews. You should never do it because the next day you're going to have to go and do something. You're going to play somewhere and you just go in and think, "I'm no good," because this guy thinks I'm no good. McCartney acknowledged, "It's pathetic, it really is. I know a lot of people who are famous and have done loads of great things, and it is common." We all need a confidant or two. With their encouragement, you still won't, can't, know for sure whether you can achieve something new, but you needn't be paralysed by anxiety. You will start to see that it's okay to be vulnerable. In fact, it's part of how we grow, as we embrace those new opportunities. I've mentioned my daughter Clara before. Clara is a beautiful spirit, one of the most giving people I have ever known. She's also very indecisive. We ask her to pre-read menus online, even when we are just going out for pizza, to help her and us when it comes to ordering. She is unsure about whether to go on to art college when she finishes academic school, so we have been holding up that reality check mirror to help her see how others, not just her family, perceive her talent, and to experiment with different courses that might help her decide. She took an art course at a well-known college and was surprised that the other students all expressed uncertainty about their future. I didn't realise other people weren't sure either. With our help, hopefully Clara will be able to see that at 17, even if she makes what might turn out to be the wrong decision, if she loses a year by taking a misstep, that will make little difference in the long term. The experience of trying something to see if she enjoys it is all she needs to focus on for now. A shortage of money can limit our ability to experiment, of course, but we still might be able to test out how much we really want something. As the daughter of teachers, my first career choice, becoming a barrister, wasn't really one I could easily entertain, as it would have involved several more years of little or no earnings after university. Nevertheless, I was able to find ways to see how much I really wanted to work around these financial constraints. I did a mini pupillage for a week and was also able to try a short law course in the holidays. The good news was that those experiences were enough for me to know that the law wasn't my calling. It's pretty obvious that if you enjoy something, you are much more likely to be good at it. University was a much happier experience than school for me, partly because my degree subject, philosophy, attracted a wide range of students. I had a mixed circle of friends, not only by gender, but by background, sexuality, and ethnicity. Philosophy also proved to be just what my 18-year-old self needed, sweeping away my lazy assumptions,
requiring a disciplined way of approaching problems and encouraging lateral thinking. Philosophy is a great equaliser. No one has the answers, but everyone can contribute to the evolution of the ideas. All that really matters is to be logical. The discipline helped me never to take things at face value and not to be afraid of challenging the consensus. Philosophy is not widely regarded as a good choice when it comes to employability. In fact, when I was applying, my parents showed me a newspaper article ranking degrees according to employment prospects. Philosophy came right at the bottom. But I was really interested in the subject, and my parents respected that, an approach that Richard and I have definitely taken with our own children. We are all diverse. It is wonderful to find a talent or a subject that excites you, and to be encouraged to develop that interest as far as you can, including reaching for the next goals. Whatever you do, don't choose a subject that doesn't interest you just because it seems to lead to an obvious safe career. The chances are you won't feel much interest in the job either. So I'm telling you to take some risks, to experiment and to stretch yourself. That may make you feel uneasy. Let me share one experience from my school days that taught me the value of overcoming that natural reluctance, that fear of failure. My first real understanding of how being a girl might bring specific challenges came in the sixth form, when at 16 I found myself alone in a class of boys taking maths at my co-educational state school. We also had two male maths teachers. Quickly exposed to the difficulties that came with being different, I wasn't just left out, but teased mercilessly, particularly when I got anything wrong, which happened often. A vicious circle developed. The more pressure I felt, the less confident and more flustered I became, which only worsened my academic performance. At the end of the first term, I felt miserable and isolated. My parents encouraged me to consider changing subjects. I was reluctant, partly because I could see that my loss in confidence was contributing to the problem. I needed to break the downward spiral. This class was the double maths group. We were taking maths and further maths A-levels. The further maths course involved 12 topics. Six were relatively straightforward, but the examiners therefore set quite unpredictable questions that would test real mastery of each subject. Six other topics were deemed hard, but only a narrow set of questions would ever be asked. A candidate had to answer just six questions. A possible way through occurred to me. By mastering the six difficult topics, I could predict the questions and be confident that I could answer them. This may sound an over-ambitious plan for someone towards the bottom of the class, but it worked. I plugged away, one topic at a time, till I conquered six. My new approach and very gradual success vaguely impressed the boys and our teachers. Slowly, I became more accepted. Alongside that personal triumph, I could see how the dynamic of that sixth form maths class changed. At the start of our two-year course, the group was competitive, and no one helped each other out, even when none of us could solve a problem. But gradually we became more collaborative. We actually started having fun. We also spurred each other on to greater success. It was many years since a pupil from the school had gone to either Oxford or Cambridge University. That year, five of us won places. One of the results of this episode was that I gained in confidence. But even more significantly, I learned to find a way through what felt like an impossible situation. This, in fact, is one of the most important tools needed if we are to fulfil our potential in the workplace and in life generally. Any career is more of a labyrinth than a ladder. There are twists and turns for everyone, man or woman, and dealing with the setbacks, learning how to overcome the natural human reaction of feeling discouraged, of wanting to walk away, is vital. The thing about labyrinths is that if you keep going, even when you seem to be walking back on yourself, you do reach the centre. My daughter Flo and I have walked a labyrinth together several times, and every time the experience has a powerful impact, reminding us that we can reach our destination as long as we persevere. But we have to stay in the labyrinth to get to the centre. Many years after my sixth form experience, Lord Davis conducted a survey as part of his Women on Boards review. Over 2,600 people responded, almost 90% of them women. When asked to describe any steps you took to overcome particular issues you faced in progressing your career, the most frequent response was, "I left the job." As my own early career experience showed, there may be moments when that really is the only way forward, but it should not be our default option. Things will never change, and we will never learn how to overcome obstacles if we always abandon ship. If the cost of childcare, a real problem in the UK in particular, where families spend around a third of their income on nurseries and childminders, is the issue, discuss that with your boss. I've seen cases where managers simply haven't done the maths and would actually much rather see what can be done to help than see women leave because it doesn't pay to work. If your career potential is theoretically encouraging but the reality left so, you need to make a judgment, and I would base that on whether the culture is right, whether you have allies who can help you emerge on the other side, or whether you are on your own, in which case it's time to move on. I have seen many more people regret not trying something than trying and falling short. But we do need to deal with the unpredictability of the outcome when we stretch ourselves, to learn to see our shortcomings as just that, rather than fatal blows. I have definitely tested the outer limits of my capabilities, and there have been moments of realization that I've taken on too much. In March 2013, I was asked by Nick Clegg, then Deputy Prime Minister, to conduct an independent review into the processes and culture within the Liberal Democrats and to make recommendations for change. The review was prompted by a series of high-profile allegations that the party had failed to act on complaints of sexual harassment made against a former chief executive. I was keen to help if I could and was particularly interested in the focus on culture. As I gathered evidence for the review, it quickly became clear that the cultural challenges, not just in the Liberal Democrats but in party politics generally, are even more acute than in the corporate sector. Party politics are intrinsically intertwined with the strong forces of personal power and ideology. Intense shared beliefs, coupled with an overt competitiveness in parliamentary politics, create a different situation than in a company. When I was disappointed to be passed over for promotion by my first employer, I was able to leave and find employment elsewhere, at a firm that suited me better. If this early career disappointment had been within the only political party that fitted with my strong ideological beliefs, finding an opportunity elsewhere wouldn't have been an option. Seeing these issues up close, interviewing people whose whole careers, friendships, and in some cases family lives were inextricably tied up with a political party, was an intense experience. The vulnerability of young researchers, interns, and volunteers working for powerful politicians was both obvious and disturbing. At the same time, employment practices were often much less formal and protective than in business, as subsequent revelations across Westminster have sadly corroborated. I needed to undertake a comprehensive review, to hear from each and every person who said they had experienced bullying or harassment. At the same time, I couldn't let the review encroach too far on either my job or my family, so I gave myself just 6 weeks to complete it. This was a Herculean task, and I was on my own, having committed to complete confidentiality for the witnesses. I got up at 3 a.m. each day and worked throughout the weekends. This inevitably took its toll on my health and family life. By the time I emerged, I knew I could not accept such a task again in the context of other big responsibilities. As we try to encourage the next generation, parents, teachers, and mentors need to strike a delicate balance. We do not want girls to be discouraged, especially when their opportunities are greater than ever before. But neither should we give the impression that everything is solved just yet. I've spoken at many schools. One of the best events was hosted by Wellington College, a private co-educational school, when Sir Anthony Seldon was an innovative and inspiring headmaster. Wellington had invited girls from six other local schools to join their own sixth form girls at a conference entitled Girls at the Top. What stood out was the candour of the speakers. The message running throughout the day was that the girls had wonderful opportunities ahead, but also should be aware that the world is not quite equal. There was no sense of trying to take the wind out of their sails, more of creating awareness to help them make the right decisions and not fall at the first hurdle if they suffer setbacks. One speaker, a headmistress, also pointed out that while it might feel very distant now, if the girls thought they might want to have children, this was something to bear in mind when they were thinking about a career choice. She wasn't discouraging them from aiming for the very top of their chosen field, simply to be mindful of other life ambitions. It's easy to compartmentalize decisions, but they are all connected. A male executive complained to me, "Young people seem not just to want a job, they want an odyssey. I thought it was marvelous to want an epic journey, and I want to encourage you to embark on your own odyssey." Women at all levels have been shown to want work with a purpose beyond earning money and getting promotions. Many of us feel this particularly acutely after having children. After all, the alternative way we might be spending our time is with them, which sets a high bar for fulfilment at work. Now the evidence suggests that as the next generation thinks ahead, both boys and girls want work with meaning, employers whose values align with their own, and balance in their lives. I asked my own children to choose 3 criteria out of 9 that were the most important to them as they thought about their adult lives. All prioritised being able to do something that makes a positive difference, and having time to spend with my family. Their 3rd choices were split between work-life balance, being intellectually or creatively fulfilled, and achieving my full potential. No one chose making a lot of money or getting to the top as one of their top 3 goals. My children's answers are very similar to those given by a group of nearly 21,000 university students as part of a 30% club study conducted over 2015 and 2016. Much of the commentary on this generation focuses on their problems, insecurities and pressures relating to social media, along with economic uncertainties compared with previous generations as they enter the workforce, including significant student debt. These are real challenges, but far from the whole story. In 2014, a young modern languages undergraduate at Cambridge University, Helena Eccles, approached me with the idea of exploring how today's students might view their own career prospects. Ambitious and clever, Helena had been surprised by what she quickly recognised to be career barriers for women during a gap year working for a well-established traditional firm. This may sound familiar. My younger namesake suspected that our efforts to encourage women in the workplace might be too late even by the time graduates start their careers, that their choices and ambitions may already have been influenced by their early workplace experiences, along with perceptions formed through the media and other sources. The 30% Club embarked on a pilot study at Cambridge University. Over 1,000 undergraduates, 42% of them male, completed an extensive survey about what they wanted out of life and a career, and their perceptions of the opportunities ahead. We wanted to explore both what young men and women had in common as they looked ahead, and also where their views about career prospects might differ. Work-life balance, a term that had not even been coined when I was a student, scored over 90% as a high-priority issue. It's worth pointing out that this survey was not conducted in the street or by phone, where students might have felt pressure to prioritise nice ambitions. They completed it in their own time and rooms. There was just one big difference in views between male and female students at Cambridge. Over half the women said they would be hesitant about applying for male-dominated sectors such as financial services or management consultancy because they thought this would limit their career prospects. Only 18% of men said they would be hesitant about entering female-dominated sectors, education, retail. Of course, Cambridge University is not necessarily representative of the broader student population, so we extended the study. 21 universities across the UK and Ireland took part, with over 20,000 student respondents covering a wide range of socioeconomic backgrounds and degree disciplines. We also extended the pilot questions to explore some areas in more depth. As we saw at Cambridge, a high proportion, 55%, of female students across the broader population said that a sector's male-dominated reputation would make them hesitant to apply. As we expanded the question set, we learned that young women fail confident in their abilities, but even before they start work, they are not convinced that they will be able to progress in any sector. Only 42% of female students felt confident that their gender would have no bearing on their career progression or pay, compared with 72% of men. This compares closely with surveys of women and men actually in work. Less than half the female respondents to Project 2840 were confident that women and men at the same level earned the same in their organisation, compared with 3/4 of male respondents. There is a gender perception gap, as well as a gender pay gap. The 30% Club student study confirmed that almost all, 93%, of the young men and women at university today are looking for a career that makes a difference. This is a huge and welcome shift from the past, when my generation expected less of an odyssey and was very focused on making money for ourselves. I believe that today we don't need to choose between profit and purpose. Commercially successful businesses over the long term will be the ones with strong values. Smart companies get this and are looking to align with the next generation's values. At a time of considerable change and uncertainty, young people may be understandably worried about their future, but should also be aware of their own power. In addition to all the other good things about them, having strong values is now seen as important. Digital expertise is also highly sought after. Those who've grown up with technology can help businesses understand new behaviours. Again, difference really can be an advantage, and you should work it. The most important thing is not to let any preconceptions put you off from doing what you really want to do, or in any way dent your ambitions and expectations. We can choose to reject the perceived limitations, but we have to get our mind around them to see that we can succeed. It is not inevitable that you will be hard done by. In fact, with all the emphasis on gender balance, there's plenty of reason to be cheerful and to aim high. That's not the starting point for many young women today. During my talks, often to all-girl groups at schools, universities, business schools, and to early career women, the same questions come up time and again. Here is the most frequently asked top 10. Girls frequently ask questions. 1. Do you feel people make assumptions about you because you're a woman? What do you do when that happens? 2. Is having children still seen as a problem? How long should you take as maternity leave? Is it a bad idea to work flexibly? 3. How do you achieve work-life balance? Is it all down to your husband? 4. Do you worry about failing? 5. How do I get started in my career if I don't know the right people, or I'm not even sure what I want to do? 6. Do you think it's hard to make progress in a male-dominated industry? Or sometimes the opposite question, do you think that sometimes you've just been given opportunities because you are a woman? 7. How can you tell what a company's culture is like before you join? What do you do if you experience sexual harassment or discrimination? 8. Is it important to have a mentor? Did you have one? Do you have one? 9. Have you found women often don't support other women? 10. Do you think men need to change as well as women? When we read this whole set of questions, we see an undercurrent of anxiety running through them. They do not add up to, I'm great, tell me how I can get on. The skew is, please tell me how not to fail, rather than, please tell me how to succeed. It's an important distinction. We behave differently if we are trying to avoid mistakes and if we are going for gold. The questions reflect where girls are today, more anxious and excited. They are genuinely concerned. So, of course, I try to address what's actually on their minds, not what I wish they were asking. 1. Do you feel people make assumptions about you because you're a woman? What do you do when that happens? Yes, though much less now than 30 years ago. People tend to project their own expectations onto others, which obviously tells us more about them than anything else. It's been assumed, for example, that as a working mother, I might not want to take on a new role, even where it might have been something I really wanted and was able to do. There's just been no discussion about it at all, apart from after the fact, when I've tried not to fall in line with their inaccurate image of me, but to clearly and calmly set the record straight. I try to engage rather than to push back, to encourage the other person to see me in a different light, and then I found they actually do. And I try not to take it personally. Behaviours are learned throughout life, and although your boss might consider himself to be very attuned to a diverse talent, he may need to undo years of conventional thinking. Help him out. 2. Is having children still seen as a problem? How long should you take as maternity leave? Flexible working? It would be naive to assume no one flinches when a valued member of their team announces they are pregnant, even if that's just because they will be missed while they're away. But you can preempt any assumptions being made about your future plans by speaking up, telling your manager that you remain ambitious, including if you're also requesting a change in your hours. Employers can't ask about your intentions, but you can tell them. If you change your mind, that's fine, but never leave a void to be filled. 2 of my colleagues handled it perfectly. They each came to see me and both made it clear that their impending motherhood did not change their commitment, although they expressed this in a very human way. Both lobbied for interesting new challenges right up to when they went on maternity leave. They used keep-in-touch days while on leave and continued to progress after they returned, irrespective of working flexibly. Their partners also took shared parental leave. It all seemed very modern and very natural. There is no right or wrong amount of maternity leave. It's a very personal thing. But I urge you not to let fear get in the way of what seems right for you and your family. Just keep talking to your employer as your plans evolve. 3. How do you achieve work-life balance? Balance means different things to different people. In many ways, I'm still working on this because I adore my